Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Welcome again to If You Love This Planet. This week, we're focusing on the nuclear industry in Britain. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Kate Hudson, Chair of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. Dr. Hudson is a leading anti-nuclear and anti-war campaigner nationally and internationally, and she's also the head of social and policy studies at London South Bank University, where she lectures on Russian and East European politics. Kate was the founding editor of the international journal Contemporary Politics, and she's the author of CND, Now More Than Ever, The Story of the Peace Movement, which was published to mark the 60th anniversary of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Dr. Kate Hudson now joins me on the phone from London. Welcome, Kate.
Thank you very much. Nice to speak to you.
Yes, now you've got a lot going on in Britain at the moment, haven't you?
We certainly have. Our current government seems to be very attached to nuclear matters. They've been attempting to press ahead on two fronts. Firstly, with nuclear power. We have a series of fairly old nuclear power stations, which the government a few years ago had more or less decided to phase out. Now they seem to be very much pro the development of new nuclear power stations on quite a wide scale. And simultaneously, they've been pursuing the replacement of Britain's nuclear weapons system. So on those two fronts, we seem to be having a pro-nuclear revival in Britain.
So, Kate, what is the pathology of this current government, and particularly Gordon Brown, that they're so pro-nuclear? Do you understand the psychology?
Well, I don't really, I have to say, because, over the years... In the party, he's a Labour Prime Minister. At different times, the Labour Party has actually been quite strongly opposed, certainly, to nuclear weapons. And as I say, they'd been in the process of more or less phasing out nuclear power. Why these two things have come to the fore in such a strong way recently is quite hard to assess. It's interesting within the Labour Party itself, the party of government, because there's a very, very strong feeling amongst the membership of that party, and indeed amongst some of their parliamentarians, that neither of these things are the way forward for Britain. They both present too many dangers. But the government really seems unwilling to countenance any turning away, particularly from nuclear weapons. And it's thought by many people that the idea of giving up nuclear weapons is something that they may see as a sign of weakness, perhaps, or perhaps a vote loser. That's an interesting position for them to take, if that is motivating them psychologically, because, of course, public opinion here has changed very strongly. During the Cold War, the majority of people, I think, wished to retain Britain's nuclear weapons system now. Polls systematically show that the majority of the population are actually opposed to Britain replacing its nuclear weapons system. So, in fact, if they thought about it again, if they reconsidered and looked at the figures, they would see that, in fact, to get rid of Britain's nuclear weapons, as indeed they are pledged to do under international treaty, could be a vote winner.
Well, I've got a couple of thoughts about that, Kate, and yes, maybe I'm right or maybe I'm wrong, but I know that the United States exerts a lot of influence upon Britain. Is that correct?
Yes, that's certainly the case, particularly around foreign policy and defence issues. There's been this agreement since 1958 called the Mutual Defence Agreement, which links Britain and the United States certainly on the level of nuclear sharing and cooperation, probably around US bases in Britain as well. And it's also thought to underpin, maybe perhaps through secret clauses, that special, so-called special foreign policy relationship between the two countries. So, indeed, actually, there are people who think that even if our Prime Minister wanted to give up nuclear weapons, the Americans might tell him not to. So, yes, I think there's very complex motivation and complex factors there.
Do you think that, you know, he could go against, he's not going to, this particular prime minister, but he could go against what America particularly wants? He would be supported, I would think, by the majority of British people. What would be the downside of doing that then?
Well, that's an interesting point, because in fact, the idea of Britain being properly independent and making its own sovereign decisions is very attractive across the political spectrum, in fact. And I think that the opposition leader has talked about Britain being more independent of the United States and not riding pillion passenger, as it's sometimes described, on foreign policy issues. Why that's been so close? Well, it's certainly the case that for a long time after the Second World War, during and after the Second World War, Britain was financially dependent on the United States. And I believe, in fact, our wartime debts were only finally paid off, I think it was something like last year, or certainly within the last couple of years. So that's been a very strong thing. But it is true that prime ministers have on occasion gone against the United States. Most notably, that I can think of just now, is that, of course, that Prime Minister Harold Wilson refused to send British troops to Vietnam as requested by US presidents. So it is possible for that to happen, but as you say, really, it requires a Prime Minister of some courage, because it's not the norm to break away from US requirements.
I'll tell you who would do it and who would have done it would have been Winston Churchill.
Well, yes, he was a very tough character, with a mind of his own, absolutely.
And much loved too, and much respected by both people in Britain and the United States.
Well, yes, he was a real model, in fact, in terms of speaking his mind. I mean, I certainly wasn't around at the time, but from what I know from history, I certainly didn't always agree with him. But he certainly spoke his mind, and in terms of the Second World War, of recognising the need for Britain to stand up, recognising the importance of non-appeasement. He was right there at the front when people in the cabinet were sort of shilly-shallying about these issues. So he was a tough customer.
Yeah, he was. I'm speaking to Dr. Kate Hudson, who's English, as you can tell by her accent, and I'm Australian, as you can tell probably by my accent. Kate is the chair of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament in Britain. Now, Kate, you've written a book titled CND Now More Than Ever, about the story of the peace movement in Britain. And I must admit, I'm now about 70, nearly. I'm about to turn 70.
You're not.
Oh, yes, I am. It just gives me the dry rot, yeah. So the book that Kate's written is CND Now More Than Ever, the story of the peace movement. And I was incredibly influenced, Kate, by Bertrand Russell, who helped to found Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, if I remember rightly. And I read his three volumes of autobiography, and I have to say that it actually changed my life. I mean, I was terribly affected by him. And there were other wonderful people in the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, Tony Foote and Tony Benn and Michael Foote and others who I just worshipped. I know that, is Ben still alive or is he dead?
Oh, no, he is. In fact, I'm pleased to say that he was on a vigil with us only last Sunday.
Wonderful.
At Downing Street.
How old is he now, Kate?
I think he's early 80s.
Oh, and what about Michael Foote?
He's older than that, but he's still very strongly anti-nuclear, very outspoken on all these issues. I have to say that I think being active in the peace movement keeps people young.
Well, I think that's true too. I mean, you know, it's done me a lot of good. I think if I hadn't been involved in the peace and anti-nuclear movement, I would have been so depressed. I mean, I think it keeps my psyche going by having this crazy notion that I can do some good. And I think we all probably feel like that. And do you know what? I think we can.
I think so too. I mean, just going out and about, I mean, I do many public meetings across the country and internationally as well, but just meeting those people, just people are, every person is quite remarkable. You know, and people come along with their views and they share them with me and I learn new things. They may come disagreeing, but we can have a dialogue. You know, people are very open.
I know.
It's just remarkable.
It's really so positive because it's to save the world. Okay, so here's the question, Kate. How are we going to turn Britain around and get all those British people mobilised to say, no, we're not going to build any more Trident missiles, Trident submarines, Trident bombs, and we're going to not build any nuclear power plants? How are we going to do that? And I must say, as I read your material, I thought, well, I'll offer my services to you. I don't know if I can help, but we really need a huge campaign, right, Kate?
We certainly do. What we've been focusing on really is building wider alliances within civil society and linking those to what's going on the kind of higher political level with our elected representatives. Because what people very often feel here, and it may well be the case in other countries too, people say, well, look, I agree with you, but what can we do about it?
Yeah, what can I do?
Listen.
Yeah, I know. When I talk to American audiences, they're very concerned. But, you know, the question always is, but what can I do? And I think I've never felt that. I've always felt that I bloody well can do something and I can change things. And, you know, I think, well, a lot of movements are led by women, peace movements, number one. And number two, we can, if we're smart enough, we can turn things around. So what's your plan, Kate, for Britain at the moment?
Well, we had a strategy discussion quite recently. And we focused on two things. One was understanding what makes people turn against nuclear weapons, because as I say, there's been this significant shift from around about 30% opposition to around about 60% opposition.
Over what period of time?
Over the last 20 years.
In Britain, okay. So you've got 60% opposed to Britain having nuclear weapons.
60% opposed to Britain replacing its nuclear weapons system. Now, that in itself is quite significant because that means it's not just people who generally would like to see global nuclear abolition,
right,
you know, which is everyone's got to do it at the same time,
right,
kind of thing, or some more abstract thing, to specifically they don't want Britain's to be replaced, which means that after a number of years when the current system has run out, it would actually be unilateral nuclear disarmament. In other words, we would just disarm on our own, irrespective of what other people do in other countries. So that's quite significant. So what we have been working out is, why has that change come about? What are the factors which have made people conclude that in the past they liked them, but now they think that they're wrong? And we have found that it's primarily two things, and this is borne out by research done by other groups, and focus groups and all that kind of thing. Firstly, on the question of cost, at a time of, let's say, economic uncertainty, you know, and so many pressing needs for investment in other things like for clean forms of energy, dealing with the problems of climate change, the problems of poverty, all those types of things, people really object to spending £76 billion of British taxpayers' money on new nuclear weapons. So that's a very strong thing. And that argument helps us, with ordinary people, it links to things like, well, why is my hospital being closed down? Why is my post office being closed down when all this money is being wasted on nuclear weapons? But also to do with the spending priorities of our government, you know, those types of things, what are their values and concerns. So there's that, there's the cost factor. Then also, I think, for me, what's the most significant thing is actually the security argument. And in the past, you know, people have tried to make out that peace activists, they're prepared to throw away Britain's security, you know, we're sort of irresponsible pacifists or something like that. But now people are actually saying that it's in our security interest to get rid of nuclear weapons and that nuclear abolition would actually make everybody more safe. And the number of people who've said, well, look how many nuclear weapons the United States has, you know, was it 10,000 or more?
10 or 11, yep.
That didn't stop 9/11. And, of course, we had terrorist atrocities here just 2 or 3 years after that, and people were killed. But our nuclear arsenal didn't protect us. the people were saying. Even our own, our former Prime Minister, Mr. Blair, said exactly this thing. He said that, you know, no one thinks that nuclear weapons are going to help us against our current security threats, which he himself identified as terrorism and climate change. So people now are starting to see them as there's something from the past, something that aren't relevant to today's needs. But also, if people, if countries continue to have them and continue to say that they are, we need them for our security, they're saying, well, other countries are going to say the same thing.
Exactly.
Then. Other countries exactly. will want to get them. So if we continue to have them when they're irrelevant,
yep.
other countries are going to want them too. So you'll get this spiral of so what's called nuclear proliferation, where more yep. and more countries get them, but for no purpose. And so that's why. I tell you, there was, it was a wonderful thing. Just 2 or 3 years ago, the former Conservative Defence Minister, Michael Portillo, who was minister under Mrs. Thatcher, who was very, very pro-nuclear, he was one of the first people, just 2 or 3 years ago, to come out and say, don't bother to replace Trident. It's a complete waste and irrelevant in every way. You know, so even Conservative frontline politicians are coming around and saying that. So you can see there's this shift. Our goal now is to get out there in society. We're doing this on a regular basis in many different ways to get, let's say our goal is another 10% of the population.
Yeah, and you've got 70%.
Nuclear weapons.
Yep.
Then we would have 70%. And what every parliamentarian, every politician says to us is that the only thing that parliamentarians mm-hmm. or politicians will listen to is public opinion,
yep.
particularly from their own constituents, because that is about the ballot box, and that is whether they get back in or not.
Well,
so
Kate,
that's
yeah.
the thing.
Okay, well, I'm interviewing Dr. Kate Hudson in Britain. She's chair of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. Kate, here's a thought. Mm-hmm. What about getting a petition and getting 60%, you might even get 70% of the British people to sign it, and you'll have stacks and stacks and stacks and stacks, and deliver them to Westminster and scare the bejesus out of the politicians, because they're only there because the people elect them. What about that?
Absolutely.
Would that work?
I think petitions can be extraordinarily successful, and they can really send a strong message.
Mm.
I'm sure you remember. Was it 8 years ago or something when there were millions, literally millions of petitions from around the world on the question of global disarmament, which went to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty? I think that those types of things are very strong. But I think also combined with that, you need kind of actions as well.
Yeah.
You need activities going on. One thing that we find very good at getting into discussion with people is having the street stalls. We also have big peace, always peaceful. Everything we do is always peaceful and non-violent. We have big protests at nuclear facilities. You know, those are the physical manifestation of these policies. We like to go there too. But a wide range of different activities drawing the popular attention and drawing the political attention to these issues. Petitions are very strong ways of doing that. But I think really trying to be active on a range of levels, getting through to people, particularly to young people.
Yeah.
And I'm pleased to say that in the past few years, we've had a big influx of young members into CND, you know, because we have many older members too who are extremely valued. Their experience and knowledge is fantastic. We want to get all the age ranges in there so that we're a very representative movement of all aspects of society.
Yes, well, I suppose you could compare that a little bit with what Barack Obama is doing in the United States at the moment, recruiting millions of young people to register. I mean, in America, you don't have to vote. And usually less than 50% of the people eligible to vote actually vote for the presidential election. And he's drawing in these Generation X's and Y's, you know, and I suppose Z's soon, who could turn the country inside out. And I think, you know, if it can become fashionable amongst young people now yet again to say, look, we're not going to have these nuclear weapons because we don't have a safe future if you continue building nuclear weapons. Now let's, Kate Hudson, just talk about how many Trident submarines do you have? On each Trident submarine, how many nuclear weapons are there? And how many, I mean, and what damage could your Trident submarines do to the planet? Could they induce a nuclear winter? And also, what is the government proposing to replace these bombs that will still work for the next 100 years? What's the story, Kate?
Well, we currently have a nuclear arsenal of round about, the number isn't exactly certain, but round about 180 nuclear warheads.
How big are they? What sort
Each one of those warheads is eight times the power of the Hiroshima bomb.
Right.
So, in fact, those are relatively small compared to many around the world. Some of them, I believe, are 100 times mm-hmm. the size of the Hiroshima bomb, or even more.
Mm.
But even with that relatively small arsenal in comparative terms, we estimate that you could kill around about 320 million people.
Right.
So that is some kind of phenomenal killing power. Those bombs, those warheads, are carried on submarines. We have a submarine launch system, the Trident nuclear weapons system. We currently have four submarines, one of which is out on continuous patrol the whole time.
Just in case it needs to start a nuclear war at any moment.
Yeah, in case they just quickly need to nuke somebody. Yeah, so that's what the system currently is. We've had dependence on the submarine launch system since the 1960s when we first bought the Polaris missiles from the United States. So first of all, we had the Polaris system from the 60s through to the 90s. In the early 90s, we introduced the Trident system. And there again, we buy those Trident missiles, which carry the warheads and are put on the submarines. We also buy those from the United States too. And it's anticipated that we will have the follow-on system will also be a submarine system too.
Yeah, so why do your politicians want to replace the warheads, I hate that term, bombs, hydrogen bombs, hydrogen bombs, with new ones when we know from scientific research by a group called the Jasons in America that the hydrogen bombs that America currently has and you have will work unimpeded, if you want them to work, for the next 100 years? So why are they being replaced? Is it pressure from the United States?
This is an interesting question. There are three parts to the system. There's the bombs, there's the missiles that carry the bombs, and there's the submarines that carry the missiles. So there is these three sections.
Right.
What the big debate was about here in Britain last year and ongoing is about replacing the submarines. And the submarines are built in Britain.
And why do they want to replace them? They're nuclear powered, aren't they? Why do they want to replace them?
Well, this is a big question because many experts, including nuclear physicists and all types of people, including from the United States, came over and gave evidence that a British government inquiry, and they said that it's not necessary to replace them now. Even if you want to continue nuclear armed, you don't need to go ahead now. These are good for decades and decades to come. Well, it's interesting. We think here that it's driven by, to a great extent, by industrial and commercial considerations.
Of course.
The groups that gave evidence at this inquiry was BAE Systems, which is the company which builds the submarines up in North England. They're currently building submarines called the Astute class, which are smaller nuclear submarines which don't carry nuclear weapons. They're conventional weapons submarines.
Are they fast attack subs?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that is very interesting what they said. They said, we want a regular drumbeat, they called it, of submarine production. And they produce one Astute-class submarine every 2 years in order to maintain their business and their commercial interests. They want a decision now on Trident so that as soon as they finish producing the Astute-class submarines, they will go into producing the Trident. That seems to be a very clear motivation. And in fact, parliamentarians, MPs were up in arms, many of them, and they were saying, you know, we have to make a decision about our nuclear weapon system based on Britain's needs and security, not the financial needs of a big company. But that seems to be a strong driving factor, and that is really absolutely outrageous.
Well, you know, Kate, I'm talking to Dr. Kate Hudson in Britain, chair of the campaign for nuclear disarmament. Let's be frank, Kate. The whole of the weapons industry allied to the Pentagon, you know, the Pentagon's run by the corporations who make the weapons, and the major corporations in America are Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, and Boeing. And they're not into just making submarines and nuclear weapons. They're into the missile defense system, which is more money, and they're into weaponizing space. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can't tell you how angry it makes me feel, and I, you know, I think that's a normal reaction, that these corporations who are stealing the taxpayers' money to blow up the planet, you know, I mean, because that could be the inevitable conclusion, just for money. I mean, how many chandeliers can a person have? How many cars can a person have? Mm-hmm. How many millions of dollars can a person get from the bonus at the end of the year? Because the CEOs of these companies make absolute fortunes.
Yeah. When I mean, it's making profit out of death. It's just terrible. And it's not just the nuclear, the nuclear weapons, it's also the conventional weapons. Yep. I mean, when you see little kids in maybe, say, African countries with small arms, you know someone's putting money in their pocket because of that trade, and those people's lives are destroyed by those kinds of wars and violence by those weapons.
You know what the next book I want to write is called, will be called, Kate? It's going to be called Why Men Kill.
Well, that's a big question, isn't it? Isn't I very it? Much look forward to reading that.
Yeah, well, I do too, because I haven't really started writing it yet. It's going to take a fair bit of research. Now, look, Kate, from this point where Britain could kill 300 million people, but I would suspect it's probably more than that, actually. Let's move on now. And I'd like to talk about your Prime Minister, Gordon Brown. I think he's got a lot of failings. But before we do that, I want to discuss this ghastly business of what they call nuclear renaissance, or the new nuclear build. How many nuclear power plants do you have now running in Britain? How many?
Well, we currently have 19 nuclear reactors.
19. Mm-hmm.
They're located at about 10 nuclear power stations in total.
Yep.
Some of them have got more than one reactor. Our nuclear plants began operating in around about 1956.
Yep.
They currently provide around about 20% of our electricity needs.
Same as America, yep.
Yeah, I think at their peak in the 90s it was around about 26%.
Yep.
But now it's 20%, which is actually a pretty small part of our overall energy needs,
mm-hmm.
if you take into account the need for other forms of fuel, transportation, and all that sort of thing. So the big debate now is, should they be replaced?
They're getting old, right?
They're getting old.
How old are they on average?
Well, they started coming in 1956. A good half of them will be phased out by 2015.
Yes.
And then the others over the next few years after that.
Yes, so, and they have to be phased out because they get so radioactive their pipes start falling apart and cracking and leaking and all of that, right?
That's right, So, I mean, as I say, in the early part of this century, the government has more or less decided not to replace them, to phase them out. I mean, I think that's certainly the case in some other countries.
Yeah.
I think Germany was going down the path of getting rid of the nuclear power stations. But as you say, they've now come round, the nuclear renaissance idea, they've now come round to
in
say...
In Germany, have they?
Well, certainly that was the case a few years ago that they decided that they would phase them out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure whether Mrs. Merkel has changed the position on that, but that's certainly what they had been looking to do.
Yeah, I think she's vacillating. So, okay, so now why suddenly in Britain has it all turned around, so they're going to build, or they want to build new ones?
Well, this is a good question. I'm not absolutely sure whether there are people there in government who actually believe this or not. My mind is open about that. But with their concerns about climate change and the problems of fossil fuels, the dependency on what they consider to be maybe uncertain sources, they've come to the view that they need to diversify their energy provision. Now, I absolutely agree. We need to be looking at other forms of energy. Where are we going to get those from? We have to look at things like energy consumption, our patterns of those types of things. We're due for a big overhaul on energy provision. For some reason or other, they have decided that nuclear power has to be at the heart of that diversification, and they have come to the conclusion that nuclear power is clean, safe and cheap.
Where do you think they reached that conclusion? Where do they get their data from?
Well, frankly, Helen, I have no idea, because the more I look into this, the more it is absolutely clear that none of those things are true.
Well, tell us how those three things are not true, Kate.
Well,
give us a lesson.
Well, first of all, in terms of clean, people like to make out that nuclear power has no carbon emissions. Now, this is absolutely not true. If you look at the whole cycle of the production of nuclear power, well, you start off probably very often in Australia mining uranium, which is the kind of the basic product that you need to develop nuclear power. You mine uranium, which is extremely toxic. It's mined in extremely dirty and dangerous circumstances, in which, I should say, there is an absolutely appalling health and safety record for those people who work in that industry. But the waste, the pollution and so on associated with that, not just sort of natural emissions through the digging process, but in terms of the heavy machinery and all that kind of thing, terrible. Then it has to be transported to different parts of the world, which, of course, is very emission-heavy. Nuclear power stations have to be built and all those types of things. So if you take it overall, it is dirtier than many other of the renewable energy or different
you
types
mean,
of sustainable energy forms. So it's dirtier than something like wind power, wave power, solar power, all those types of things. So the idea that it's clean in the production process is not true.
In then, terms of, course, in terms of CO2 emissions?
CO2 emissions.
Yes. Yep.
Then, in terms of being clean and safe, look at the question of nuclear waste. Right, the process of producing that nuclear power, making it into electricity in those power stations, produces the byproduct of nuclear waste, which can be radioactive to a very, very high degree. Some of the waste associated is quite low-level radiation, but much of it is very high-level radiation. For viewers, for listeners who don't know about this, radiation is something which is associated with the production of nuclear power and nuclear energy, and it's you can't see it, but it floats around out there, and it is the cause of things like cancer clusters, leukemia, birth defects, all those terrible things associated with the dropping of the atom bomb and the nuclear testing. That is also associated with the waste which comes from producing nuclear power. So it is a very, very dirty industry, both at the kind of making it end and the after end. And the worst thing, really, that we've found here, Helen, is that the government recognises that there is no safe storage method. I mean, we have nuclear waste lying around in trenches here in Britain because there's no safe permanent way of storing it. The government currently has been talking about burying it in Cumbria, which is in northwest England. But even the geologists are having a big row about this, because if you're going to bury something like that underground, you have to be sure that the ground is stable, in thousands of years to come, because this stuff remains poisonous for thousands of years. You've got to be sure that there's not going to be an earthquake or a land move and it's going to kind of come out or going to contaminate the water or something like that. So even the government recognises that there's no safe storage method. So we're already poisoning our green and pleasant land here in England. And they're talking about producing lots more. Completely irresponsible. So that's that. It's not cheap. It requires huge amounts of investment over the decades. I think when the British government first started producing it for kind of civilian consumption rather than just using it to produce nuclear weapons, they said, we'll produce energy too cheap to meter.
Yep.
This is always the big promise about nuclear power. But in actual fact, our British nuclear power industry has required huge amounts of government subsidy.
Mm.
And in fact, they've been calculating recently, what is it going to cost to clear up the sites, these sites that are having to be phased out, irrespective of whether or not they replace them. £73 billion
yep.
is the current conservative estimate. Experts and politicians recognise that that is likely to rise. So that's $73 billion just to try and clear up the current power stations and the mess associated with them. So who is going to pay for those costs in the future? Are the companies that come in and want to build new nuclear power stations, are they prepared to foot that bill? The government is very vague about this. I suspect that bill is going to come back to the taxpayers, but irrespective of the money, look at that danger. You know, we have cancer clusters around nuclear power stations here in Britain. You know, terrible health problems associated with it. Why should the government do that? But also in terms of can nuclear power solve the problem of climate change, people say, oh, well, it's so urgent. Climate change is so urgent. We need to deal with it. I absolutely agree. But, you know, to build a new nuclear power station, it can take 15 years mm-hmm. to get it up and running.
Mm-hmm.
15 years, that's too long.
Too late.
The climate change issue is so urgent. And, you know, you can build a wind farm in a year or two.
Yep.
Nuclear power it's too little. You know, it's only something like 4% of our total energy needs from our current 19 reactors. So even if you built another 19 reactors, it'd be too little, it would be too late to solve the problem of climate change. Why go down this disastrous, dangerous and dirty path? It's just not worth it, Helen. And I can't see why our government doesn't understand that. If I can understand the basic science, they can surely understand it too.
Do you think it's got? Do you think there's a hormonal factor in this, Kate, where people can understand and can't understand, huh?
Yeah, so something we should do is big blinkers.
I call it nuclear insanity. This is Dr. Kate Hudson, isn't she lovely? Chair of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament in Britain. And I know that in America they're having similar arguments, but by God, do you know, I always think of La Pasionara in Spain, who spoke up against the Spanish Civil War. I think we need people to be so outspoken and so passionate, but somehow grab the media so that they are impelled to cover us, do you know, Kate? And I also think of Gandhi, you know, he went back to take on the British Raj in India, not with a gun and a uniform to dress up like the Brits, but almost stark naked in a loincloth. And he led a salt march with dignity and sagacity and wisdom. And that was in a sort of an asymmetrical tactic. You know, how do you get it? You won't get at them by using their tactics or their thinking. You've got to be really clever like Gandhi to develop some asymmetry so that it's so obvious what has to happen. Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. I think that governments are very clever at trying to draw you into their framework.
Yes.
And I've seen, you know, somehow they sort of invite you for a meeting.
Yes.
And you sort of can get sucked into just talking about it and feeling that in some way you're a player because you're in their meeting. What happens as a result? They listen, they smile. I mean, I'm all in favour of dialogue. But it has to be proper dialogue where people listen genuinely and they're prepared to move on it.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes people go along to these meetings with ministers or with civil servants, and it's just a way of fobbing them off, Helen.
Right.
And I do see that sometimes with campaigners or people in movements and so on. We mustn't get sucked into that because they will only listen when they are really made to listen, and that is when the weight of public opinion and the compelling arguments and all that sort of thing are posed there against them.
Well,
we can't just fall into their framework.
Not at all. So now, Kate, tell us about the leader of the opposition. I know that he's a man who does care about climate change. He's an environmentalist. He works with the Goldsmiths, Zach Goldsmith, who's a great environmentalist. Is he...
David Cameron.
Yes. Is he opposed to nuclear power, Kate?
It doesn't seem to be so. I believe that they have supported the government's energy bill. It's quite interesting, you know, because when he came in as the new leader, and he's a relatively young man, and sort of fresh, different approach and all that kind of thing, and he was very much questioning, you know, raising the issue of climate change and so on. Very important. That's good. And he has helped raise awareness of it. But he seems to accept nuclear as part of that package. We wrote to him, actually, when he came in. We wrote to him from CND, and we said, this is at the time when he seemed to be really questioning on the energy front. And we said, you know, we really welcome your approach. If you're having a rethink, you know, and looking at things freshly, will you consider rethinking nuclear weapons? And he wrote back. It was a very friendly letter, but he said that, and he said that we should approach their party's commission that was looking into this, but he personally remained in favour of nuclear weapons. And I don't think we're going to get any shift there. Although, as I said earlier, you know, I mentioned Portillo changing his mind. There are people on the Tory front bench who've changed their minds on nuclear weapons also, and I imagine so on nuclear power. But really, on these big issues, you find that those two big parties, the Conservative Party and the Labour Party, they have very similar views on these things, and it's really the opposition within those parties, and there's quite a strong opposition within Labour, as I said, to these issues, but, and individuals in the Conservative Party, it's really left to them to speak out. And, of course, to work with other smaller parties who are opposed to these things.
I think, Kate, that the time for CND is again come. And I know in the early 70s there were huge marches. In fact, I actually was in one and addressed, I don't know, 250,000 people in Trafalgar Square or something. And I think the time's coming again, particularly as the young people get concerned. And I think... Do you know, I'm glad I'm nearly 70, Kate. I mean, I don't want to die, but if I was young now looking towards the future, instead of thinking about the romance and the joy and being a doctor and how exciting life would be, I would be scared. And I think a lot of them are. And I really do think that if we can encourage the young people to get going, people listen to the youth. They, you know, we love them. They're our future. I think that's right. Yeah.
And what we see, I mean, we see young people, they don't really go towards the political parties. That's the reality. I mean, some do, but it's quite unusual for a young person to go and become a party activist. They do get involved in single-issue campaigns, issues of conscience, you know, very strong on the environmental issues, for example, also on things like animal rights.
Yep.
You know, those things touch people. And when I was young... thinking about the early 80s in particular, when I went on my first demonstrations, it was those big CND demonstrations against cruise missiles in Europe. It was the big anti-apartheid demonstrations. Those were the kinds of big issues then. For young people, at the moment, it's very much the environmental issues, but also, of course, anti-war. Mm. And what we're trying to do, we've had a very conscious policy of this, making the links between the different issues. Nuclear weapons, they're not campaigning about them isn't some sort of specialised ghetto where you have to know a lot about technical nasty kit. It's part of a wider process. It's inextricably linked to the environmental issues. Mm. It's inextricably linked to the anti-war movement. And where the young people, they're in the forefront of those things. We bring in the anti-nuclear issue and make it part of what people can understand. It's not a separated out thing.
No.
It's part of the wider campaigning.
Well, Kate, this is Dr. Kate Hudson, Chair of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament in Britain. I'm thinking of all the people listening to this broadcast in the United States, particularly young people, but everyone. And I think that it would be good for the movement in America to join up with you, the movement in Britain. So, Kate, do you have a web page that people can go to link with you and work with you and join up together?
Yes. Our website is www.cnduk.org. That's www.cnduk.org. There you'll find contact details, well, all kinds of information about all our different campaigns. You'll find contact details for how to email us. You can join in debates on the blog that's there. There are all kinds of ways you can get involved with us. I have to say, Helen, that when we look at the United States, obviously we are in disagreement with your administration there on many things, but we see the marvellous people of the United States. We've got very strong links with many of your peace movements over there, United for Peace and Justice, also many of the anti-nuclear campaigning groups, and we see how marvellous and how active so many of the US people are.
And wouldn't it be wonderful if there could be an exchange, you know, young American people coming over and working with you, that would, you know, give you vitality from another perspective, and vice versa, British people going over and working with the Americans.
Let's unite
and hold hands across the Atlantic, because Britain has a big impact in America. Do you know what I wish? I wish the Queen would do something decent on this, you know. She's the Queen of the Commonwealth. She's our Queen in Australia. Isn't it time she took a stand against, you know, mass murder with the terms of nuclear weapons and nuclear power? Wouldn't you think that would be a good thing for her to do?
It would, you know, because this is an international problem.
Yep.
Nuclear weapons, nuclear power, they're an international problem. We can't deal with them in isolation in our own countries. Obviously, we have sort of national specifics that we need to work on. But international cooperation, coordinating our activities, being in dialogue, learning from each other, Helen, that is, for me, that is the core of how we're going to move forward, working together globally.
Do you know what? We could all go to the Queen's garden party, you know, dress and hats and gloves and stuff, and, you know,
nice
go
frock.
And talk to the Queen and say, now, look, Your Majesty.
Well, she may well be very sympathetic.
I think she might be sympathetic. She's a pretty fine dame, I think.
She's a very decent person.
Yes.
And, of course, you know, her son, Prince Charles, will be king, you know, after she passes on. He's very strong on
the
environmental issues.
Yes. Where does he stand on nuclear issues, Kate?
Well, I haven't heard him say, you know, and they're required to keep off very controversial things. He's managed to make the environment and things like organic farming and all those sorts of things.
Mm.
He's managed to play a role in that and to make it acceptable to talk about these things. He's done a lot to make it a kind of respectable thing to care about where your food comes from.
I would think, because he's very intelligent, that he is opposed to all things nuclear. So it would be interesting if we could get to him at some point. I understand he mustn't be, controversial, but, you know, being against, you know, annihilation of the planet, that actually isn't controversial, and it really is conservative, because we're the conservatives. We're for conserving life. Mm. Those who are for nuclear weapons and nuclear power, they're really radical, don't you think?
Well, I do. You know, and what's interesting, I mean, maybe your American audience will know a lot more about this, but we've heard recently that quite unusual people in the United States are speaking out against nuclear weapons. I'm talking about this initiative from Henry Kissinger and George Shultz.
Yep.
I don't know if you've heard about that.
The Four Horsemen.
That was a shock, you know, because in the past, they have done things that were absolutely unacceptable to the peace movement. I don't want to go into the details. But now, for those people to speak out, that's very unusual to me. And maybe they are having an impact there. I mean, I note that nuclear weapons have been a bit of an issue, to say the least, in the presidential campaigning.
Mm-hmm.
Is that because very mainstream people are saying, turn away from nuclear weapons?
Well, I think it helps.
That's unusual.
And Obama is for abolition of nuclear weapons.
Mm.
McCain isn't. But, you know, I hope Obama wins, I have to say. Well, look, Kate, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today. I'm really very grateful. If there's anything I can do or we can do to help in any way at all, we will. And what we've got to do, of course, in Australia here right now is to stop this country mining and selling uranium, which is a fuel both for nuclear power and nuclear weapons. That's our responsibility. Yes. So thank you, Kate, very much for coming
on. It's my pleasure. Keep in touch. You're a great inspiration, Helen. I'm sure you're aware of that, and we so much appreciate what you do.
Oh, well, we appreciate you, Kate. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That was Dr. Kate Hudson, Chairman of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament in Britain. If you would like more information about the CNDE in Britain, or would like to get a copy of Kate's book, CNDE, Now More Than Ever, The Story of a Peace Movement, you can go to their website at www.cnduk.org.
The dark cloud above you, dialing the number whose body station. I'm a little bit corny. I'm a wildflower waving for you. Broadcasting tower waving for you. And I'm sending out this signal here. I hope you can pick it up loud and clear. I know you don't like weak women. You get bored so quick. And you don't like strong women, 'cause they're hip to your tricks. It's been dirty for dirty down the line, but you know I come when you whistle and you're loving and kind. If you've got too many doubts, if there's no good reception for me, then tune me out. 'Cause honey, who needs the static? It hurts the head and you wind up cracking, and the day goes dismal from Breakfast Barney to the sign of prayer. What a sorry face you get to wear. I'm gonna tell you again now, if you're still listening there, if you're driving into town with the dark love above you, dialing the number who's bound to love you. If you're lying on the beach with the transistor phone, smoking, call me at the station. The lights are open.
That track was Joni Mitchell. You Turn Me On, I'm a Radio.
What you're about to hear now on If You Love This Planet is part of a speech given by Joseph Cerincione at a symposium held by the Nuclear Policy Research Institute in Washington, D.C. Joseph Cerincione is currently the president of the Plowshares Fund. When he gave this speech, he was director of the Non-Proliferation Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. The symposium, titled 3 Minutes to Midnight, The Impending Threat of Nuclear War, took place in January 2004.
Over the last 3.5 years, we have had a very dismal record on fighting proliferation, a dismal record on enhancing arms control arrangements, a dismal record on sustaining and enlarging the entire non-proliferation regime. And in fact, we've seen an alternate view of how we should deal with these problems emerge from the White House, from the National Security Strategy, one that that sees the world in a more unilateral manner, one that seeks to impose a U.S.-dominated set of arrangements and solutions, one that divides the world into good guys and bad guys, and we can, you know, pick off the bad guys. What's the proliferation problem? It's the axis of evil. It's Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. These are the bad actors. It is no longer the 40 to 50 year tradition that has guided this country's policies, which is that the problem was the weapons themselves. Since John F. Kennedy warned us in 1960 that unless we did something, by the middle of that decade, there might be 15, 20, or 25 countries with nuclear weapons. We have focused on eliminating the weapons. The view has been that it's the weapons themselves that are the problem. As long as these large stockpiles exist, they would someday be used. So we focused on eliminating biological weapons, eliminating chemical weapons, promising to eliminate nuclear weapons, actually making some remarkable progress over the past decade and a half. The global stockpiles are half today what they were at the height of the Cold War in the mid-1980s. The current administration adopted an entirely different view of the problem and focused on these good guys and bad guys. And in essence, saying it was okay that some countries had nuclear weapons. Well, we've had a very unintended result from the application of that policy. And I would argue that if you look at this situation now, we're actually in a fairly good situation for non-proliferation and arms control. But the overall thrust is clear. There is very little talk in Washington about further military adventures. And you remember in the heady days after the fall of Baghdad, there was talk about going on to Syria. talk about overthrowing the Iranian regime. You don't see that. The president has backtracked from that. The Iraq war has proven to be such a disaster, so costly in lives, in finances, in alliance relationships, in international stability, that we are hamstrung. We cannot afford to undertake new military arrangements. We could not undertake a military operation, even against a state like Libya, if we wanted to. So we're forced back to this policy of diplomacy, which turns out to be a good thing because it works. We don't know how long the situation will last. But the results are good. The results are we're making progress, and we face the prospect that we may actually be able to resolve the rogue state problem. That for years, the number one proliferation problem, certainly for this administration, and even for periods of the previous administration, has been the rogue state problem. That's what they're worried about the most. We might actually be resolving this. Depends how quickly we can do this, how long this will continue. If we can do that, that will be an historic moment. Because there is not a long list of these states. It is not true that proliferation is spreading inexorably around the world, that the technologies are more and more easily available, and that we're on the verge of a world of 20 or 25 nuclear states, the way Kennedy warned us 40 years ago. No. After Iran, Iraq, Libya, and North Korea, there really isn't anybody else. Syria, some people talk about, some concerns about chemical weapons, some minor issues on nuclear weapons, but very short range. Algeria, some concern about that reactor, but really minor concerns compared to the threats presented by Iran and Iraq and North Korea. So we're on the verge of solving this problem, and if we are able to do it, for whatever reasons, under whatever administration, it's going to be our job to make sure that we quickly turn our attention to the far more serious problems that have been ignored. And number one on that list for me, the number one proliferation problem, is securing the stockpiles of nuclear materials and nuclear weapons in the states of the former Soviet Union and resolving the situation with Pakistan. If you believe, as I do, that the number one threat to international security in the world right now is the possibility of a terrorist group getting a weapon of mass destruction, then you have to be concerned not only about combating the terrorist groups, you have to combat the supply side. Where are they going to get it from? They're not going to get it from Libya. Libya doesn't have nuclear weapons. They're not going to get it from Iran. Iran doesn't have a nuclear weapon. They're going to get it from that nuclear Kmart that we call Russia, where there are over 20,000 weapons and 1,000 tons of weapons-related material, much of it stored in insecure conditions. We have to lock up and secure and destroy and eliminate those stockpiles, those weapons, as quickly as possible. Senator Sam Nunn says we're in a race against time. To me, that's the number one proliferation danger, seconded by the situation in Pakistan, not because the Pakistan government is going to turn over any of those weapons to terrorists, but because that is an extremely unstable situation. A turn of fortune, a few seconds in the passing of a car by a bridge, could mean whether or not Al-Qaeda has a chance to grab one of those nuclear weapons or not. So I worry greatly about the situation in Pakistan. Those are the issues that we should be turning our attention to. That's where we should be concentrating our efforts in the future.
That was part of a speech given by Joseph Cirincione at a symposium held by the Nuclear Policy Research Institute in Washington, D.C. in 2004.
Thank you very much for joining us today on If You Love This Planet. A very special thanks to our host Pacifica station, KPFT.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and edited by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.